Welcome back to the Accelerators Podcast. We are radiation oncologists Drs. Matt Spraker, Simmel Parikh, and Anna Lauschus, and we're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. Note, the discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. And now, on with the show. All right, welcome back to the Accelerators Podcast. Got another episode today for you. Let's go ahead and introduce ourselves before diving in. I'm Matt Spraker. I'm a radiation oncologist in Denver, Colorado.
I'm Simmel Parikh, also one of the co-hosts of the Accelerators and medical director at Lake Huron Medical Center in Port Huron, Michigan.
Hey there, I'm Anna Brown, one of the other Accelerators co-hosts and a radiation oncologist in Wisconsin.
I am Liz Chow. I am a clinical geneticist in Southern California at UC Irvine, and I'm also the chief medical officer at Ambry Genetics. We are a genetic testing laboratory that provides testing and results to patients.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Chow. I think we use first names on the show, so just, you know, we'll kind of do that for all of us, so we can have you go by Liz. So today we're going to be talking about medical genetics, and I think it's a really important part of every kind of oncology program. And I wanted to actually start just by asking you if you could describe a little bit for us kind of like what your clinical day job is, because I learned as I was prepping for this that I got a little confused about who actually works with patients in the centers and how these programs might be set up inside a cancer center when patients are referred for genetic counseling.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. So obviously there are different models at different institutions, but most of the time medical genetics is a collaboration between an MD geneticist, such as myself, and usually one or more genetic counselors. And so usually the genetic counselor is the first clinical contact with the patient. They're able to spend quite a bit of time with the patient, you know, at that first consultation, getting a full complete family history, full pedigree, doing what we call cancer risk assessment. So getting all the details from that family history, as well as their own personal history, and then looking at it and seeing if there are any signs or patterns that might be consistent with an inherited cancer susceptibility. And then usually a physician like myself will be involved at a number of different levels. There's a lot of compliance where, you know, we review notes, cases, do sign off, things like that. But also in running the program, I'll see some of the more high-risk patients. And in some cases, the clinical geneticist might fully manage, you know, a high-risk program, and including, you know, all the different screening modalities and follow-ups and things like that. So I think it can work differently in different settings, but it's almost always collaborative.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I think we actually, when we talked about planning this episode, we started out talking about kind of pancreatic cancer and testing for that. I know, Simmel, you had kind of brought that up. And that was actually news to me. I think, you know, a couple of years ago when I was graduating residency, I did not think about sending new diagnoses of pancreatic cancer to programs. I was telling you just before we started recording that my current job, we actually work pretty hard on this, and we've had access to medical genetics counseling and visits as kind of like a quality measure, something that we're using for our quality program. And we're doing pretty good on pancreas, so I'm excited about that. But all this is like brand new to me this year. Can you speak a little bit about recommendations for germline testing for pancreatic cancer, new diagnoses, and why this is important? It might just mean my ignorance, but I don't know that like this is widely known, right?
Sure. I mean, I think the data for inherited susceptibility in pancreatic cancer has sort of amassed over the last maybe 10 years or so. I actually tried to go back and doing a little research. I was looking at NCCN guidelines for testing yesterday, and I was trying to figure out when pancreas first appeared in the NCCN, but they had so many different versions, I couldn't quite figure it out. If I had to put a guess on it, I would say it's been there for around 3 to 5 years. And the guidelines recommend testing in any new diagnosis of exocrine pancreatic cancer, both for the person that's affected and or for any first degree relatives. And that's primarily, you know, we always like to do testing, first of all, in an affected individual. But with pancreatic, that can be particularly difficult. If we don't do testing at the time of diagnosis, it's often difficult to do so later because of the mortality and morbidity associated with that condition. So they actually recommend testing in first degree relatives as well.
What was the driver for this recommendation? Are you able to like kind of identify a sentinel like study or event or a reason that we started talking about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I go back further, I would say that in 2006, there was a paper published in Nature that identified a new breast cancer susceptibility gene. So at that time, we really mostly thought about cancer susceptibility in the setting of like BRCA1 and 2 breast and ovarian cancer. But PALB2 was really sort of like the third, you know, the next really high risk breast and ovarian cancer gene that was identified. And what then quickly followed on that was the identification of PALB2 also in pancreatic cancer susceptibility, along with primarily BRCA2. So I think it was like in the late, you know, right around 2010, 2009, 2010, that pancreatic sort of came to awareness as being in a way like a partner with breast cancer susceptibility. So what we were starting to find is that genes that were involved in increased breast cancer risk also increased risk for pancreatic cancer. And that has turned out to be true as we've done more studies, you know, sort of throughout the next decade. Other genes like ATM, for example, which moderately increases risk for breast cancer, maybe 2 to 5-fold, also increases risk for pancreatic cancer as well. So they seem to go hand in hand mechanistically, impacting various aspects of DNA repair, essentially. But the data now is pretty clear. So for example, having a germline mutation in one of the BRCA1 or 2 genes increases the risk for pancreatic cancer significantly. And if you go back the other way, the reason we're doing testing or recommending it now in all individuals with a new diagnosis is that about 2 to 5% of individuals with a new diagnosis will turn out to have a mutation in one of these genes.
And so, and I guess my question is like, if you're let's say that you're at a cancer center and you're as ignorant as I was about this, and you're kind of at a higher level and you notice that you have, you know, maybe a lot of centers, like they tend to send patients for medical genetic counseling if they're like younger patients. I think classically, like if you have a very young, kind of surprisingly young patient with a diagnosis, you might send them. But you're now saying that we should do this for all new diagnoses of pancreas cancer. So what, like why do it? I mean, what will that offer for your program? And do you feel like that the benefit of this does outweigh the theoretical cost to your program? We're sort of, it's backtracking a little bit because the recommendation is there. So I'm not like kind of pushing back against it. I just am curious kind of a little bit in the details, what you might expect if you run a cancer program and you want to start doing this.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, when we're thinking about whether to test someone, do genetic testing, or think about inherited cancer risk, we're usually thinking about individuals who are young, you know, clusters of cancers and families that are otherwise unusual. But then there are these exceptional, you know, specific histologies that also make you think of doing, you know, genetic testing. So for example, pediatric adrenocortical cancer, you're going to think about doing testing for TP53. And it turns out that just because it's common enough, pancreatic cancer falls into that bucket where across the board, and we've haven't been able to sort of like tease out a subset, you know, that really helped us to enrich for finding individuals with mutations. So if you just look across the board at new diagnoses of pancreatic cancer, that's where you get that positive yield of around 5%. And it goes a little bit higher than that if you include some other, you know, moderate risk genes.
That's higher than I would have guessed, right?
Yeah.
So what happens if someone is screened and then they, you know, kind of test positive for a cancer gene? What happens to them and then their family? I particularly am interested in this because with pancreas, as a lot of our listeners will know, we don't have good screening tests, right? So you're kind of going to tell a a sibling or a child of a patient, that they have this gene that puts them at higher risk of pancreatic cancer, and then presumably, you know, just like tell them to go away and tell them, wish them luck, right? There's probably action we can take.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's obviously really challenging. And you're right, we are not good at screening for pancreatic cancer. So that is a big challenge. I think the benefits when we identify an individual or family member are twofold. One, in somebody who's actually affected with pancreatic cancer, there are now treatment implications. So, you know, PARP inhibitors may have some role and may have a growing role in treatment of some of these cancers. And that we've been learning more about over time. So that's a direct impact. That's also helpful because, you know, when patients access genetic testing through a new cancer diagnosis, from my perspective, it's really too late, right? Telling someone that they're at increased risk for pancreatic cancer now that they have it is also not very helpful, right? So it's the family members who are unaffected who we really want to be able to reach out to. And in that setting, I think, you know, aside from the potential cancer treatment implications in the patients, most of the genes involved in pancreatic cancer risk also convey risk for other cancer types. So for example, if someone winds up being diagnosed with a mutation in BRCA2, they're also at increased risk for breast and ovarian and as well metastatic prostate. So we do have better screening modalities for those types of cancers. And depending on their age, we can recommend interventions that can be very effective, for example, in preventing breast and ovarian cancer. The other diagnoses that we can make aside from BRCA 1 and 2, pancreatic cancer susceptibility is associated with Lynch syndrome, which goes along with increased risk for colon, uterine, and some other cancers. So almost always when we identify one of these genes, there are additional cancer risks that we sometimes can do more about than the pancreatic cancer, where screening definitely has its limitations.
And in the patient, the index patient that we originally sent that has the diagnosis, it might also affect treatment recommendations, as you said, with the systemic therapy. Or like, it, you know, for us, for radiation oncologists that treat pancreatic cancer, that is controversy in whether we should really be treating them at all, right? And if someone has Lynch syndrome, certainly that pushes me in a direction kind of away from being enthusiastic about treating them with radiation in some cases, yeah. So yeah. I've been, Simon, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just, in a broader sense, I mean, like what Ambry's doing and what companies similar to them are doing is it's really hard for us as providers. Like you're saying, like, you know, you're board certified, you know what you're doing, and you know, we weren't all aware that we should be getting these tests for pancreatic cancer patients. The list of patients that need testing or would benefit from testing is incredibly long. And as, you know, I've talked to Ambry folks, and during my visit, I mean, we know the numbers too. Only something like 5 to 7% of patients that need genetic testing, not just pancreas, but all cancers and all, you know, that need this type of screening are getting it. I mean, think about that. Like, we're 7%. Like, that is terribly low. And we have a chance, you know, to make that number higher. Part of it is like educating us, like maybe us three and people that listen to it will remember for pancreatic cancer, but we're not going to memorize the guidelines. Like it's just not doable for most people. And I think that this awareness of like whether or not a patient needs it, like it's not always obvious because it's not a 32-year-old woman with a triple negative breast cancer. Okay, obviously we know what to do here. But if it's a colorectal cancer, or if it's whatever type of cancer in whatever type of constellation of other patterns that we see in the family, we need to get better at directing these patients, not just to order the test, but pre-ordering the test to figure out if we need it. And I think that's like a big, big gap right now. We're not shilling for Ambry or anything like that. It's a big void, you know, in our knowledge, I think. We just don't talk about it. It's interesting. We talk about pancreas cancer all the time on Twitter. No one ever mentions, oh, did you get a genetic test? You know, like, I just don't see that discussion coming up. I love that we're able to be able to get better educated about this. And smaller hospitals, like I tell you, I'm in a small acute care hospital. We do not have a genetic counselor. We are busy. You know, the medical oncologists are busy. Everybody's busy. And so, you know, places like Ambry, the pro, you know, they also provide the genetic counseling, not just the testing, but if you utilize their program, they're also providing the counseling, which is really great for a rural area or a small community hospital.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talk about that a lot just in the field of medical genetics, because as you said, we can't see everyone. We don't see everyone. Most providers and other specialties are sort of unaware of who needs a genetics referral. I think, you know, it's interesting because genetics is one of the required courses. Everybody takes it in medical school. It's required. Almost everyone takes it in their first or their second year. And then it sort of goes away, right? And we don't see, you know, providers really thinking about it. It's the same idea too. You know, the family history is a required part of every H&P, and people write a few things down, but they don't really think, even in the primary care setting, often very deeply about it, or what should be done with that information once they've recorded, you know, what your parents or your grandparents passed away of, and they sort of move on. But we definitely, it's a huge issue in the field of medical genetics in terms of educating providers. But we also, as you point out, have a workforce problem. We don't have enough geneticists or genetic counselors to see all the patients that warrant referral. And it can be really hard for patients. You know, we do see at our institution as well, we have oncologists who choose to send their own testing, for example. And that's great because we can't see every patient. But then some of the results that come back are quite complex, complicated, you know, different variants that come back. It's not always straightforward. And then, you know, we get those referrals. And sometimes we feel like we're cleaning up a little bit after other providers have ordered a test that they're not sure what to do with the results. So how you set up the program within the institution and how individuals, especially in rural areas, access to genetic counseling is not great. There are a couple of large telemedicine groups, and I think that's becoming more acceptable, that, you know, we'll see and counsel patients by phone or by video calls. Some payers are now requiring genetic counseling before they'll pay for genetic testing. And while I think that's fantastic in theory, doing the pretest counseling, I think, has huge benefits to the patients. So they know what they're testing for and what to expect. It also can present itself as a barrier to access because they don't have enough genetic counselors available to do that type of work. So, you know, I think we're all looking for suggestions for how to educate providers and make them more aware, not to memorize the guidelines, but just to have a general awareness of who needs to be referred. And that really is our job to dig into those nitty gritty details and decide, you know, who specifically needs testing and what type of testing they need.
Are you able to put a number on, like, just estimate of how many, like, just in general, if we send everybody, right, what percentage of patients that you do pre-testing genetic counseling for will ultimately then have a genetic test? Are you able to estimate that just high level? I realize there's a lot of factors that might affect it from center to center, but.
Yeah, I mean, the number is quite high. I would say that like 85 to 90% of patients who go for pre-test counseling wind up being sent for genetic testing. Having genetic testing ordered, but I do think it's a very self-selecting group, and that would not be the optimal program, is that we would see a lot more people and have that risk assessment discussion because, you know, we're sort of seeing more of the obvious ones and or the individuals who have selected to come see us. We do get a good number of self-referrals from individuals who are worried about their family history for a particular reason.
That makes sense. Yeah. And it's totally true. I mean, it's like, just thinking about my own practice, like, I don't just send everyone, I send the people that I think need the testing, right? So it's not surprising that most of them get it. I wanted to pivot a little bit and ask you just about some more general kind of questions that I personally had about genetic testing that I thought about for a couple of years. One thing that I thought was very interesting when in my last job, I was working in a center that was in a neighborhood where people had a lot of kind of socioeconomic risk. There are a lot of barriers to access to care. And one thing that we talked about quite a bit was, like, if, you know, say you have a patient that comes to you and you do a medical genetics, you know, kind of counseling appointment with them, and then they have like family members that are at risk, but they're not patients in the center. Right. So they're kind of just people out in the world and they're not your patient. And so how do you, like, get those people, you know, access to care, and how do you reach them, I guess, because it's sort of the immediate thought is it has to go through the patient. But like, say that the patient has a lot going on, or they're under treatment, or they're busy and they just don't, or maybe they're not close with the family members. Is that a challenge that you see, or is this just something hypothetical that I came up with?
No, I think it's a huge challenge. And I think, you know, most people who try to practice in this area are aware of it, because a lot of the benefits, I sort of alluded to this earlier, from genetic testing come through what we call cascade testing, right? Which is that we identify the proband or that index patient. Most often they come to attention because they have a cancer diagnosis. And then once we find a mutation in that patient, we test their family members. And that's where we have the greatest opportunity to benefit, because they're unaffected by cancer. So, you know, in an optimal world, we'd identify them, we'd enroll them in these high-risk screening programs, and we'd prevent a lot of cancer. But there are a lot of, barriers to accessing care, especially with family. It's a whole new group of challenges. I think one thing, you know, the challenges are great across a number of different communities. When there's not, you know, broad insurance coverage in a community, that can be really challenging. One thing that has come up over the last couple of years is a lot of genetic testing laboratories now offer essentially free testing to family members within the first 90 days. So when you get that diagnosis back from the index patient, you have sort of a brief window of opportunity to send in, you know, to find those relatives, right, which is a challenge in and of itself. We can send them saliva kits in the mail, for example, that can make it a little bit easier. And the lab will do the follow-up testing for free, not broad testing, but just looking at the one specific familial mutation. So that gets us one step closer to making the diagnosis in family members. Of course, then we still have to be able to do something about it. So knowing that, you know, you have Lynch syndrome without having access to regular colonoscopies, again, is not that beneficial. So we are making progress. I think the availability of free to low cost familial testing, the ability to send out saliva kits, that's been sort of huge over the last few years, because in our practice in Southern California, we'll even send the kits to family in Mexico and things like that. It's not an issue to send them across the border. They come back, they get the testing. But, you know, you still have questions about what type of counseling they're able to get, what type of follow-up they're able to get. There are still significant challenges out there. It's not just knowing what's in your DNA, but being able to follow a plan to do something about it.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, because I think I asked you this before. This was a little bit uncomfortable for me, because I had a real situation where I had a patient who did get received genetic counseling, had a mutation, and then the counseling service in my cancer center like started to work with the family members. And then what had happened was that the family member who did not have cancer, was not our patient, had a separate primary care doctor that was outside our system that actually was discouraging testing. As oncologists, we work a lot with people who are not primary oncologists that offer very important services like genetic testing, or palliative care is a great example. And it's probably a lot more publicized. There's even papers written about how some oncologists can kind of push back a little bit if you try to refer people to palliative care. Have you had issues with doctors pushing back against family members being tested? And if so, like, is there something we can do about that? To be fair, I didn't want to impinge on the guy's practice, and I kind of just talked to the family and I offered them a second opinion, but I wasn't sure if that's something that you see in the genetic counseling world, or is there just lack of, if people are a little weary and they're sort of against testing, even though it is part of the guidelines.
Yeah. I mean, I think the setting where I feel like we get the most pushback is in the setting of an active cancer diagnosis from oncologists. And I get a lot of, the most common type of pushback I get is, well, you know, right now we need to take care of the patient. You know, we have an active diagnosis. The patient's going through a lot. They might be going through, you know, radiation, chemotherapy. I'm not going to worry about genetic risk right now. I just need to treat, you know, the family needs to deal with the cancer that we have right now. Maybe in a few years, you know, we'll follow up, or that might be a more appropriate time to do a genetics referral. So I hear that a lot, from oncologists who just don't want to sort of muddy the waters. That comes up a lot too, you know, now that a lot of oncologists are setting these large tumor panels, either, you know, through liquid biopsy or solid tumor testing, where they identify something that might be germline, but you don't know because you've only tested tumor tissue. we'd like to see those patients, you know, to do additional testing and find out if there is inherited risk. But again, there's a lot of like my, you know, the patient, the family is too busy right now. I'm not going to refer them until things settle down. And there's obviously some merit to that. But there's also, you know, the flip side of things sort of not getting lost and handling them while they're most acute in the mind of the patient. I think in general, like the example you gave, obviously different providers have different opinions. So that comes up. I haven't had a lot of pushback, you know, people will see different doctors, they have different opinions, but in the primary care setting, I think mostly primary care doctors just aren't interested in dealing with genetic testing that can be complex and all the pieces that go along with it. So I haven't had a lot of that where we've had difficulty getting referrals, where we've asked primary care doctors to participate in the care or maybe be involved because, you know, a family member is in a setting where they can't see a geneticist. There, it's been really challenging because I think a lot of providers just don't feel equipped to be part of the process of counseling and ordering genetic testing.
What, what about, Fred, that person who doesn't have active disease that may worry about this idea of, well, if I have a genetic mutation, my insurance might change or my premiums might be affected. In certain communities, there's a touch of paranoia about things like that.
Yeah, for sure. And we get asked that question a lot. So, you know, there was a hallmark legislation that was passed called GINA. I'm trying to remember the year it was. I think it was early 2000s that protected, you know, genetic individuals with a genetic diagnosis from discrimination across a number of areas, including, you know, employment, health insurance, a variety of different other areas as well. So we always discuss that with patients. Often, even if they don't ask, we'll bring it up. There are a couple of notable gaps in that legislation. One is long-term disability insurance, and the other is life insurance. So we do discuss that. It's not so much an issue in the setting of cancer risk, but for example, if we're doing genetic testing for something that might lead to a long-term disability, you know, if we're going to diagnose risk for Huntington's disease, for example, we always discuss that with patients and we give them the opportunity to, patients will actually, you know, leave the first counseling visit, go out and explore their options for those different types of programs. And we'll specifically ask them to do that before we order the genetic testing, or at least to think about it. So that's not an uncommon question to come up. The history, I guess, of sort of the case law since GINA was passed has been pretty much favorable towards patients. There haven't been, you know, successful examples of health insurance, for example, still being able to discriminate or raise premiums or things like that. It has been actually quite effective from what we've seen.
So people have actually challenged that law, that act, and it's actually stood up and protected patients the way it's supposed to. That's really reassuring to hear. Because whenever these new acts come out, you always wonder, like, you know, it just takes, you have to see someone challenge it and make sure it actually stands up before. Yeah, that's actually a really good question and a great point. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the future. So I was joking before we started a recording that I loved the tweet from Simmel visited your guy's lab and he put on a white coat and did a little, he was like pipetting or doing something. You guys are doing lots of cool stuff. And I think we spent a lot of time so far talking about when to send patients and how this affects with pancreas and other types of diseases. But where is this field going? I mean, it's like all genetic things is probably moving very quickly. What can we be excited about as oncologists?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, you know, obviously I think clinical genetics is really exciting. In the last, you know, 10 or 15 years that I've been practicing, things have really changed dramatically. We didn't talk about it so much, but a lot of that was really technology driven. We're able to sequence DNA faster and cheaper now, you know, by orders of magnitude than we could, for example, when I was first starting my fellowship. So that's really changed access as well. Because, you know, costs have come down and we're able, for example, to look at, you know, broad panels of genes instead of just one or two genes. But I think, you know, the future is really exciting. I think on the cancer front, there are some challenges. You know, a lot of the low hanging fruit has really been plucked. So people ask all the time, you know, when are we going to find BRCA3 or are there going to be new cancer susceptibility genes coming out? And the answer is probably yes. You know, we'll continue to sort of eke out new discoveries, but the bulk of it is sort of already there in terms of just new genes or new syndromes, similar to what we've described previously. Each new gene sort of accounts for a smaller and smaller piece of the pie, and, you know, it is rarer. But because of the technology, we're able then to continue to look for mutations in those genes, even though they're not common. I think as a field, you know, where are we moving? There is a significant movement towards what we call universal screening, which is the idea that everyone should be looked at for hereditary risk, you know, and that would include cancer. It might include cardiovascular conditions like arrhythmia or other types of adult set cardiomyopathy, things like that, that have a significant impact and where we have an opportunity to intervene. And there has been, you know, a good amount of work. Mary Claire King, who's at the University of Washington and was one of the pioneers in this area, has done an extensive amount of work now looking at universal screening programs and the idea of, you know, should everyone be tested? And then, you know, everyone would know their risk and we'd be able to manage them more effectively and not deal with this, you know, problem with referral selection and so forth. There would obviously still be access to care. The other point I just want to mention is that this might, in fact, be taken out of all of our hands, because I think, you know, whole genome sequencing, which will eventually and very likely be universal, is coming at, you know, a reasonable price point and at a place where insurers are starting to cover that. So if you think about a world where whole genome sequencing might even actually be the platform on which we perform newborn screening, which is actually a test that happens for every, you know, newborn born in this entire country, and we don't have trouble with access to care. If every newborn, for example, was able to get their whole genome sequence as a basis for the newborn screening program, we would then have that data available to interrogate at various other time points in the life. So even though we would initially use it perhaps for newborn screening, we could then, you know, ask questions, for example, if a child developed, you know, a series of disabilities or conditions that had childhood onset, as that individual grew up and thought about starting their own family as a basis for, you know, prenatal genetic counseling, and then thinking about cancer risk at any time during adulthood, we would have access to that information. So it would no longer be a question of do we test, but do we actually just go back to the data, which should be a simpler and less expensive process, and ask new questions as an individual grows up and they reach different time points in their life. So I think that's what's probably most exciting for me, is getting to a place where the DNA sequence is available and we just get to ask questions about it. And you can almost envision a world in which, or a time in our country in which that type of access might be relatively universal. And so some of these issues with access and family members might go away.
And real quick, when you talk about reinterrogating, so the idea would be that you would collect the sample, the tissue, whatever you're testing on, you would collect that at, you know, at when they're born, basically, right? And then that sample, like you basically sequence it at that time, and then you'd have a data set for the patient. And so when you reinterrogate it, you're really just looking at that original data set. You don't actually retest things. You don't keep sample and retest them later, that kind of stuff. Is that correct? Or is it?
Yeah, no, that's correct. That's what I was referring to, because your germline genome is not expected to change over the course of your life. So, you know, once the technology is stable and we have access to the appropriate way to store this type of information, you know, privacy concerns, it's not simple. But I do think it, as a model for healthcare, it is simpler overall than the way we're practicing now. And the UK is actually piloting this process. At the moment, they're going to do 10,000 newborn genomes. And because they have a national health service, they have some advantages in terms of how they access, store, and reinterrogate that data. But it will serve, I think, as an important pilot for different ways that it could be done here. And there have been some pilot programs done in the US as well. Geisinger is a healthcare system in Pennsylvania that's done some work in this area. So we are trying to build the models, even though, as you said, it's quite a ways off. If you think about when we might sequence a newborn whole genome as part of a routine process and then reinterrogate it, you know, 45 years later, you know, we're talking about many, many years in the future where we'd be doing that sort of work. But yes, going back to the data and asking different questions.
So for community providers out there, I kind of want to talk about how we were introduced. I work for a small hospital in Michigan, and when I interviewed they had talked about this program that they were joining with Ambry called the CARE program. And, you know, we are almost there. We almost have our paper signed, and it's going to be a great partnership. But would you mind spending a few minutes talking about it? Because, you know, I don't work for you guys. But I do see the value of a program like this or similar ones, and why it would be beneficial to a lot of us out here.
Sure. So CARE is a digital healthcare tool, and it's something that our laboratory provides with the goal of solving some of the problems that we've already talked about. So, you know, providers in practice who are not specialized in genetics aren't often aware of the guidelines or many of the nuances involved in the guidelines. It can be challenging to take, you know, a full and complete family history and really integrate the sort of risk assessment that needs to be done into the medical care setting, you know, if you're not practicing genetics, if you're a primary care provider or an oncologist or another type of specialist. So CARE is a tool that really focuses on, you know, asking the patients questions. It's a digital health tool. It's basically a series of questions that gets pushed out to the patient. It can go out in a variety of different ways through their smartphone or, you know, other platforms where they go through and answer questions about their history. And the risk assessment is provided by the tool based on NCCN guidelines and ultimately, you know, decides based on the answers and a decision tree that's built into it, whether that patient should be referred for genetic testing based on their answers to that, to those questions. So it helps the physician or the provider to triage the patients and to focus on those who need referral or need or should be sent for genetic testing based on their history.
So yeah, there's the clinical aspect, which is awesome, which helps us as providers. And then there's also the payer relations aspect that, you know, I've spoken to them as well. And then how do you guys kind of monitor that and make sure that, you know, patients aren't stuck with a bill or anything like that?
Yeah, so that's always a challenge, we know we do have a lot of programs that are in place to help patients manage the costs that are associated with genetic testing, including low to no cost testing. But also, I think it's really important, you know, building the payer relationships between a genetic testing laboratory and making sure that those tests are covered, and then working, you know, collaboratively with payers. And in my role, I've had the opportunity, for better or worse, to meet with a lot of payers or insurers and medical directors there. And, you know, very often they really are interested in covering services. They just don't know how to do it, or they're really scared of the consequences of, you know, opening something up to coverage. And so I've personally had a lot of experience sort of talking this through and you know, working on building policies where genetic testing really is well covered. I think that, you know, the next push or what we see on the future in this area is expanding that beyond just some of the panels we use now in cancer to look at, you know, more expansive testing. And as I said, moving towards, you know, whole genome platforms in the future that would sort of cover all needs. But yes, right now, you know, we are using the CARE platform to direct individuals to testing and then to make sure not only that the right individuals are getting tested, but that it would be covered by their insurance. So there would be no out-of-pocket cost to the patients, which is usually pretty important.
I was looking at this on your website when you guys were talking. This is really cool. This is like what, in my opinion, one of the best uses of digital health. Like, I think bringing a service where you have a workforce challenge to a rural hospital and using software to try to help streamline the process for a very like kind of discrete service that, you know, has clear benefits for a small but significant portion of patients, I think it's really cool. So this is a cool program. I'll definitely link it when we release the show. I had one more question. We actually have a few more things to talk about. We're getting close to the end here. But I had one more question. I don't know if you're on medical Twitter, but there's lots of debates. Sometimes they're not the most professional debates, but there is a cohort of people on there that is sort of like anti-screening, not it is scientific. And I think it's a valid and reasonable position to take, because I think that, as you probably know, a lot of the screening trials, and so this is like not for genetically predisposed people, but just general population, a lot of the screening trials, the benefit is hard to describe and it's often small, right? And so a reasonable oncologist can think that we over-screen people and it's creating problems. So I'm just trying to put my hat on, like, if I was in that group, which I'm not, I'm a big screening fan. But when you're describing taking germline testing on babies, banking their entire genome and then reinterrogating it throughout their life. My immediate concern is like, are you going to be creating patients that otherwise wouldn't exist? Or are we going to over-treat people for things that maybe won't harm them? Because as you know, there, I mean, you know, low grade prostate cancer is a great example of something where you might have that genetic risk, you might have the disease. Sometimes we can't even tell the patient that it's going to hurt them. And so is that something that you guys think about? And is there, what would you say to that cohort that, you know, would, might worry about mass screening of babies in the United States?
Yeah. I mean, I have not actively, I'm going to go out and take a look at it now that there's an anti-screening cohort on medical Twitter. So I'm not incredibly familiar with that, but I'm interested to hear what they have to say.
I'm not necessarily suggesting you go on Twitter and start engaging with all these people, but either way, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I completely agree with you. There are limitations to who we should be screening and in what settings. And I think like from a genetics perspective, we've actually been quite careful about this in the past with the idea of, you know, even only referring for testing individuals who have that high risk, because we don't want to overscreen. And actually, I didn't mention this earlier, but for example, you know, even in an individual with a BRCA2 mutation, because pancreatic screening is not that effective, we don't actually recommend it in all individuals and families who have that particular mutation in that particular gene. So we actually limit it further in the case of BRCA2, only if there actually are individuals in the family who've had pancreatic cancer. So if that family is just breast and ovarian, we know there are some families that have more pancreatic and some that don't, and we can't really tell the difference based on the mutation. So we look at it clinically, because if screening is not particularly effective and it's invasive and it has other risks, you know, absolutely there's a place where we are overscreening. And overscreening also, as you alluded to, can lead to overtreatment. And we've seen that with, you know, PSA and prostate cancer and things like that. And in some cases, you know, DCIS, you know, everyone at this mantra of early detection, early treatment clearly has its limitations. And we can all think of examples of where that's true. So I think that's something to be cautious of. I think the way we're thinking about it in genomics is, you know, even though the DNA sequence might exist from a very early age, there still is that opportunity. You wouldn't provide a newborn with information, for example, about their cancer risk. And that's where that reinterrogate piece comes in. You would address that later on, you know, as that individual maybe enters their 30s and they're starting to think about, oh, you know, maybe should I be getting mammograms? I know, you know, there might be some family history and things like that. And so the opportunity to access the data at that point would still be a question and would still be a place where I think, you know, pretest counseling would be appropriate to discuss what sort of questions we could ask. And so there does need to be, you know, gateways around the data, who accesses it, at what time point, and then how it's used, because we want to do, you know, more good than harm. And I think we're all generally aware of the fact that, you know, more information is not always better.
Yeah. Well, and whether something is good or harm is sort of an individualized decision or opinion, right? And so I think it's always important to remember that when we talk about these things, our conversation today is about groups of patients, right? Or talking about policy, or like Simmel's thinking about his cancer center and making a program for the entire cancer center. But it goes back to what you said. It's really why there needs to be either digital health tools or increased workforce, because the counseling piece goes with it. Presumably, if you meet with the patient prior to genetic testing and you talk with them about the pros and cons, and then they ultimately decide they don't want to do the testing, you don't force them on it, right? Just like anyone else with screening. And so I think that those are great points. And you know, to that group, certainly compared to other types of screening, as you said at the top of the episode, we're probably underutilizing this anyway. So I think we're not really in a place today where there's a concern that we're over screening people for genetic germline mutations that can impact families. And so and one last point on that, I actually went from a group that, I mean, I was at WashU before. You mentioned there's a lot of researchers there, but clinically, I would say, at least in the groups that I were with, this is not like a front of mind thing that we were using a ton. I'm now treating kind of all types of cancer, and we use it a little bit more in a lower volume center. So it's kind of more front of mind for me. I just see it more and more on more cases. And we've had patients where we've ran the testing and then it's affected what we do clinically. A really great example is like, we ran testing, they have a gene mutation, then they end up seeing gynecologic oncology for a prophylactic, oophorectomy, for example. And we found patients that have had cancer in there, like tiny focuses, like, you know, 1 millimeter of cancer. And to be honest, like when you see that and it comes back to tumor board, the whole group feels like we saved somebody. And so I think when you see those things, it's really easy to get super excited about genetic testing, because that's the kind of thing that you can kind of see it in action, right? And it's not always easy to see that, I think, as an oncologist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the last part here, I wanted to ask you a little bit about you personally, because you shared a very interesting, important point with us here. Hopefully you're comfortable talking about this. It's a very positive thing, but we can share with the listeners that you actually at one point were a radiation oncologist. Is that right?
I did. I started my residency training in radiation oncology because that was my plan coming out of medical school, is that I was going to go into that field.
So you love the field, and you know us quite well. But I think it's really cool. And I remember when we first talked about this, you actually were like, you were saying that, we talked about whether we wanted to share this or not, because changing fields is kind of something that I think is not super common in the US when people go into training. But the point is that you started the field and then you found something you were like super passionate about, and now you're there. Do you feel like you made the right decision?
Yes, with hindsight, I feel like I've absolutely made the right decision. You know, I really love what I do, and I love the fact that I got into genetics at the time that I did, and was able to see, you know, so many of the changes that have come to the field over the last 10 to 15 years, and been able to be a part of that. But you're absolutely right. I did sort of share that in confidence, because it's not something I often talk about. You know, as you can imagine, partway through residency, when you're like, hey, I don't think this is for me, I'm going to go out and, you know, find a different specialty and leave the program that I had started. That's a really difficult decision to make, and impacts a lot of different people, and is not something that I often talk about, you know, when going through my background, is that I started out down the path to radiation oncology.
We can cut this, by the way. It can still be in confidence if you wanted to, but I do think it's nice for people to hear, because, you know, on the other end, when I was a trainee, I met people that had transferred into radiation oncology. So one of the residents I loved working with as a medical student was a neurosurgeon, and then came into radiation oncology because it's better. Everyone knows that. And he was like super happy. And I think we shared with you that you were unaware completely that there's kind of like a lot of tension and controversy around matching into radiation oncology right now. But I think what's really important to remember, and what you're a great example of, is that any trainee in medicine really has to follow their passion, right? Because it is a demanding job and you do it day to day. And if you love it, then it makes you really happy. And you're obviously passionate about medical genetics. It's really cool to see how it's impacting people with cancer. And so presumably you still feel like you're making a huge impact in the oncology world. And I think that that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a little bit like naive. My initial viewpoint as a medical student was that if I was interested in cancer genetics or cancer, I had to be an oncologist, right? And so that sort of led me down the radiation oncology path. But we sort of, with a broader vision, like realizing that I could access it in different ways, and, you know, going into medical genetics was just a matter of me meeting the right mentor, who was a medical geneticist, and he had done his training. I had no idea, you know, to even think about cancer from that perspective. To me, medical genetics, and, you know, I love the pediatric piece of it as well, but that was sort of what I'd been exposed to in medical school, and not, you know, that you could have a whole practice centered on, you know, elevated cancer risk and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I'm thrilled that I made the decision, and really happy that I moved into genetics and was able to approach my career from this perspective. But it's always challenging at the time to know if you're doing the right thing. It's much, much better with perspective over the years.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have advice? We have a lot of trainees that listen, people that are just interested in oncology and may not have committed to a specific path down that. Do you have advice for people? We share a We share a similarity in radiation oncology that medical genetics is probably a field where you don't see it early in training. You don't get lots of exposure to it. You mentioned in passing that this all came about by a chance encounter with a mentor that pushed you into this field. I had the same exact thing for radiation oncology. Do you have advice for like younger trainees or earlier trainees that, you know, to just get exposed to medical genetics and all the greatness that comes with it?
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested, like everyone takes that first or second year course. So, you know, if that's interesting to you, if, you know, there's a lot of aspects, I think, of medical genetics that appeal, you know, can appeal to a medical student. You know, there's the real science of it, because I do feel like we get to do science in our everyday life, which isn't necessarily true in all fields of medicine, right? We also get to spend a lot of time with patients, talking to them and, you know, really getting to know them, which I think can be a benefit. But I think just keeping your eyes open, because for example, you know, medical genetics still, unfortunately, is not a very competitive field to match into. We're still, you know, I can plug here, trying to recruit. It's a really exciting growing field. But we don't get nearly as many applicants as we'd like. And I think, you know, for a variety of the reasons that you mentioned, and not having the right mentors in place or the right exposures. But I think for medical students and trainees, just thinking very broadly, you know, you may have heard of a few specialties that you have more exposure to, or you think that they create a great lifestyle or, you know, fit with what you've heard, but just looking outside of the box at different areas, and you never know what's going to happen. You know, I didn't know when I went into medical genetics that, you know, we were going to sequence the human genome and technology was completely going to change and revolutionize the way we do genetic testing. That was just sort of a happy coincidence of timing, but it really led to so much, you know, satisfaction and passion that I've been able to develop in this field. So I think just keeping your eyes open, trying some of those electives that maybe you hadn't thought about. And I think you're right, you know, you as well, mentorship is key. Who you meet and what you see them being successful and passionate about, I think is really, really important.
Yeah. And in a broader sense, I mean, like, I think medical students, and no different than any other human being, like I was the same way, but we get the tendency, unfortunately, to buy when the stock is high, and we may undervalue the stocks that are lower, or the places that the specialties that are less competitive, and they may be less competitive for a reason, or they just may be, people may be unaware of them. And I think, I don't think people will admit to this, but I am pretty sure people just rule out specialties based on how easy it is to get into, because med students are they're achievers, and they want to have something to put up on the refrigerator for mommy and daddy to see. And I get that. Like, I did that too. But I think like it would be really a different experiment to like only go through the ones that are less competitive and kind of see like, huh, maybe I can find a gem in here, a diamond in the rough. I think about genetics, like I really love the classes. I love doing it in college. Super interesting stuff. I know it's not the same as Punnett squares and whatnot, but I would think, and I, you know, you're an example of it, but I think it gives you some broader career opportunities. I think it's very difficult for radiation oncologists to break into industry. But I think having a genetics background or a genetics residency or fellowship or whatever, however the training is, would make you very attractive, maybe not for full-time work, but even consulting work or, different projects, because a lot of this stuff is in the private space. That's what's really exciting about genetics, medical genetics, is you got people like Ambry are doing it, Marriott are doing it. It really is coming from the private sector, and it's super exciting. Like your technology and your labs, it blew my mind seeing the campus. And I think you picked great. I don't think you would have been happier doing what we do. We love what we do, but you really are excited about what you do, and that's the goal for students. They should want that in their career.
It's a good point. It does seem like it has a very like really nice industry kind of clinic industry partnership happening with medical genetics. It's really a nice place to work. One thing that you said too in passing, that this is what drove me to radiation oncology, is it's one of these fields where you still get a lot of time to like sit down with a patient. And if they're a scientifically oriented patient, you can sit there and talk with them for 2 hours about all the nuances. And if you're a passionate person, which you clearly are, that's like the best visit in the world. And those, that space for that is rapidly decreasing in modern medicine. And I think it's finding those fields where you can still carve out that time to sit with patients is like really important. That's one of the things that drove me to radiation oncology. And so that some of the things you said that you love about your field are actually true about radiation oncology. So I can see how there's some overlap there. And so it's great that you ended up in a place where you're clearly passionate and super happy. And I think that's really important. Final word. I think we took a minute over our time here. Any final thoughts from anybody? Or all right. Well, appreciate you very much coming on, Dr. Cho. I think it's we had a great discussion here. I learned a ton from it, and I really look forward to kind of how this field will move forward and how it's going to impact our practices in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This
was great. Thanks so much for joining. This is great. Appreciate it.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.